It's springtime in Kansas, which means prairie burns. Every year, farmers, ranchers, and park rangers set fire to a portion of the tall grass prairie in order to renew the soil and promote plant diversity. For those of us in Kansas City, a trip to see the prairie ablaze this time of year might not be so easy to pull off, but a book of photographs called On Fire by Larry Schwarm not only submerges readers in the surprising beauty of the prairie burn, but also gives you the feeling that there's something unreal going on in this place. Something almost impossible to describe. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today, Central Standards book critics will recommend their favorite books that really convey not just what the prairie looks like, but what it feels like, too. Katie Stover of the Kansas City Public Library, welcome to the show.
Oh, good morning, Gina.
Mark Luce of Barstow School, hello.
Nice to be here.
And Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, freelance book critic for the Kansas City Star. It's great to see you.
Good to be here, Gina.
Katie Stover, share your top picks today.
Well, today I brought with me that classic of the prairie, Little House on the Prairie by Laura Ingalls Wilder. And then I also brought the book that's turning Laura Ingalls Wilder into an even bigger cult figure than she already is, Pioneer Girl, the annotated autobiography edited by Pamela Smith Hill and from the South Dakota Historical Society Press.
Talk about the phenomenon of that book, because it's been insane.
Oh, my goodness. It has been insane. I don't think anyone really understood what a cult figure Laura Ingalls Wilder was. And Jeff and I were talking about this in the green room. One of the fascinating things I learned about this book is that the initial press run was 13,000, and the South Dakota Historical Press thought that was respectable. They'll sell all that. They'll make a nice profit. They'll pay all the bills. The press that went through the roof, the orders for this book, they're about to go into a fourth printing. They've sold 75,000 copies of this book. That sounds amazing. And the heartbreaking thing is that the press has not made one dime off of this book yet.
That's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
We had this author on, and you know, I could not even get a hold of a copy of the book to prepare for the show, not from the publisher, not from the libraries. It was all the copies were off the shelves, not from any store. They were totally gone. What does this say about how deeply people connect with writing? I mean, part of it is Laura Ingalls Wilder. Part of it is the characters in the book. But part of it really is her way of evoking the landscape.
Yes. And that's what it is that's drawing so many folks to this book in particular. They want to know more about the Laura they fell in love with in the series of books. I don't know where I got my copy of Pioneer Girl. I'm in fear of going out to the parking lot. Can I have a guard out to the park in my car? I'm pretty sure I'll get mugged by a Laura cultist.
This is like a $40 book, right?
No, it's a $50 book.
Oh, okay.
So, Katie, have you enjoyed reading it?
I have, especially since I've read the entire series. And last night, I picked up Little House on the Prairie and Little Town on the Prairie, which is one of the happier books in the entire series, and went to those years in Pioneer Girl to see, well, what did Laura truly write in her autobiography and what got massaged ostensibly by her daughter Rose Wilder Lane for Little Town on the Prairie. And it's very interesting that while those were happier years, it would appear that Laura Ingalls Wilder was not as polished a writer as her daughter Rose Wilder Lane was, and that Rose took a great many liberties with her mother's stories, adding a lot of pop, a lot of color, a lot of drama to situations and fleshing out the elements of her mother's life, which I am told her mother took issue with. And you can read about that in Susan Whittig Albert's A Wilder Rose, Rose Wilder Lane, Laura Ingalls Wilder, and Their Little Houses, which is about the relationship between the two women as they were.
So what's the title of that last book again?
The last one from Susan Whittig Albert, A Wilder Rose, Rose Wilder Lane, Laura Ingalls Wilder, and Their Little Houses. And this book is about the two women writing together, maybe, the Little House series of books. What were Laura's contributions? What were Rose's contributions?
Katie, you know, if you were to say that the prairie, as described by Laura Ingalls Wilder, as conveyed by her, has a personality, what would you say that personality is?
It's welcoming yet austere. It's beautiful and distant. It's got an undercurrent of fright, We don't really – we'll see that in other works that I know that Jeff and Mark brought. But Laura Ingalls Wilder does touch on the scary nature of the prairie, much like the ocean is scary. There's things that you cannot see in those grasses. There's animals that hide. There's people that just seem to walk out of thin air.
There are long expanses of land in extreme weather as they're traveling in the covered wagons.
It's weather, it's time, it's space. Space can be very scary for these settlers. Just because you can't see anything doesn't mean nothing is coming.
It's open and closed at the same time.
It is.
I feel like I had a Laura-deprived childhood.
Jeff, are you confessing to something right now?
Yes, indeed. I have not read the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, I'm sorry to say. And my husband, Tom Averill, read the Laura Ingalls Wilder books when he was in the fourth grade. And my teacher, I mainly remember that she sat on top of her desk with gold cat-eye glasses and read to us. And I discovered through reunited with a high school best friend that she was reading us The Wizard of Oz. But all I remember is her cat-eye glasses.
You were distracted.
See, I read Farmer Boy in third grade because it had boy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's... And I looked at him. And people read them in our – I worked in the library in grade school, and I couldn't walk – the same way you can't walk around – like a boy can't walk around with Nancy Drew. A boy couldn't walk around with Little House on the Prairie. But if there's a boy with a cow, then that's cool. That's okay.
That makes sense. Yeah. And hopefully there are boys these days reading Little House on the Prairie. But Katie, before we leave this segment, do you have other books that you wanted to recommend having to do with the prairie?
Well, the last one I brought is Caddy Woodlawn by Carol Ryrie Brink. This is a childhood favorite of mine, and it won the Newbery Award in 1938. And this is a marvelous read-alike for anyone who wishes they could revisit that Little House on the Prairie feel from their childhood. If you're looking for something new, you want this. And what's interesting is that this book is about the Wisconsin frontier. And when you say frontier and prairie, you probably not think in Wisconsin. But it's a wonderful read-alike for Little House on the Prairie.
Katie, title of that and author of that book again?
Caddy Woodlawn by Carol Ryrie Brink.
Central Standard will return with more books about the prairie. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with some bookish people who have great springtime reading recommendations. The theme for today is prairie, books about the prairie and books set on the prairie. Mark Luce of Barstow School, what books have you brought in today? What do you think really captures the prairie in a compelling way in writing?
Well, for me, I grew up in central Kansas, and my grandparents ran a quarter section and then a half section. And when my granddad passed in 1986, the half section disappeared. My grandmother passed a couple years ago, and the quarter section mostly disappeared. And my parents recently have a handshake deal to sell the house that's on that section. And so for me, it's like that sort of whole idea, and then talking about the prairie, kind of those things dovetail together. It's like there's always a sense of nostalgia. And I think that on some level, there's also always a sense of lost. The plains, I think, are a place that are wonderful for community, but they're also a place of extreme isolation and oftentimes loneliness. To me, there's a beauty in that. In Tracy Letts' play, August Osage County, which is actually set in Oklahoma, which I would still consider to be the plains, Bill and Barbara, who are an estranged couple, Bill says, anyway, if you want me to explain the creepy character of the Midwest, you're asking the wrong. And Barbara responds, please, this is not the Midwest, all right? Michigan is the Midwest. God knows why. This is the plains, a state of mind, right? Some spiritual affliction like the blues. And Bill says, are you okay? I'm fine. Just got the plains. And I always really like that. That particular line, because I think it kind of captures that thing. It's like, yes, I love the land, and I feel connected to the land, especially in central Kansas. But there is this, I think you mentioned, Katie, austerity to it.
It's like a moodiness.
Yeah. But it's
not moody like off the rails moody. It's like it's just a subtle mood that's like under it.
It's eerie.
It's eerie. I think there's a hint of melancholy in it. And it's fun, you know, and I think especially if you leave Like, I mean, technically, I didn't leave the plains. I technically still live on the plains. But there's a difference between a farm outside of Salina and, you know, an independent school in South Kansas City. Like, I'm a, like, if you look at me, you're like, oh, that guy is an English teacher, right? Just by looking at me. But then my heart is a farm boy. And sort of trying to find that balance between the two things. And
so I think that's your interior geography.
My interior geography is farm boy, without question.
Mark, can I just, when you're talking about all of this, does this depend on the season? Like, springtime on the prairie seems so vibrant and almost celebratory to me, but maybe not to you. I mean, I am from the city, so when I go to the prairie, it's a new, fresh experience for me.
Oh, I think that the prairie in the spring and then in the early summer at harvest is a wonderful thing. But it's also like every time that something blooms, it's like that means that right around the corner is a lot of hard work.
Yeah,
and that hard work never goes away.
Good point.
One of my favorite books about the plains, and it's sort of about the plains, it's sort of not, is William Maxwell wrote a book called So Long, See You Tomorrow. And he was a longtime fiction editor for The New Yorker. And you talk about an urbane fellow. Like, this guy is as urbane as it gets, but he's a Nebraska farm kid. And in this novel, he recounts a series of events that happens in this small town. And so the book is somewhat about memory. It's also about friendship. And he has this wonderful quote where he says, what we want, or at any rate what I refer to confidently as memory, meaning a moment, a scene, a fact that has been subjected to a fixative and thereby rescued from oblivion, is really a form of storytelling that goes on continually in the mind and often changes with the telling.
Wow.
And I love that idea where it's like I remember things from growing up and doing things, crazy things with my cousins, but it's like, do you really remember? Are you remembering kind of the right thing?
So you're really tapping into the nostalgia that the word prairie evokes for you.
Yes, but I think it invokes that for a lot of people, especially people who left. And I think Willa Cather is a great example of that. Willa Cather basically left Nebraska and spent her time in the East.
And this is early 20th century author Willa Cather.
Yeah, and so in My Antonia, she puts herself in the form of Jim. I don't think it's any stretch to say that Willa was a fairly masculine presence. I mean, she dressed as a man at the University of Nebraska and caused a big ruckus. But I think the thing that you see there is Jim comes back.
So Jim's the little boy.
Jim's the one telling the story, and he goes back east and he comes back to see his old friend that he grew up with. And to me, it's like nostalgia evokes like, oh, 50s people doing like dancing to Elvis and that kind of thing. To me, nostalgia is undercut with a kind of melancholy. But her descriptions of the prairie were the first time where I was like, oh, you can do this with language. Like, you can describe physical landscapes and have them evoke an emotional sense. And before that, the real sense of the prairie that I got was primarily visual, either through what I saw or a dear friend of mine. His mother is Terry Evans, who's a fairly famous photographer. And so her first book, Prairie Images of Ground and Sky, which came out in 1986 from University of Kansas Press, has a foreword by Wes Jackson. And I saw the prairie in a totally different way. I saw the prairie as sensual. I saw the prairie as alive and not just crops to be cut down.
And that's in Prairie Stories by Terry Evans.
Well, that was in this was her latest book, Prairie Stories.
She does aerial photographs, right?
Well, she does both. But yeah, she does aerial, and especially in so she did Disarming the Prairie, Inhabiting the Prairie, and what you see is, I mean, it looks like bodies from the sky. She had a retrospective, I think, 2 years ago at the Nelson that was absolutely stunning. But so for me, the prairie has a very personal kind of feeling, and I carry that, I think, with the lit. Like, when I read literature of what I would consider the Midwest or the plains or the prairie or whatever, I have a very emotional response to it.
So you've recommended Willa Cather's My Antonia, which we reached out to staff and three of us mentioned that we would recommend My Antonia. And then one person recommended the whole trilogy by Willa Cather, O Pioneers and Song of the Lark, yes. Mm-hmm. But so, Mark, I'm going to have you hold that thought because we will hear what Jeffrey Ann Gowdy of the Kansas City Star thinks we should be adding to our bookshelves soon. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard. I'm here with Katie Stover, Mark Luce, and Jeffrey Ann Gowdy. These local reading experts are recommending great books with a prairie theme in honor of springtime in Kansas. The prairie burns are going on right now, and Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, what made your list of top prairie books?
Well, first I'd like to say something just general. We've been using prairie and plains interchangeably, but there's actually, strictly speaking, a difference, and that is the 100th meridian. And areas of land that are east of the 100th meridian get 20 or more inches of rainfall a year, and areas that are west of the 100th meridian get less than 20 inches of rainfall a year. And so some people are really sticklers about that. But I think more what we're talking about is the prairie or the short grass prairie, the tall grass prairie.
The prairie definition also includes like how many trees there are per acre, I think.
Oh, dear. I didn't get into that.
But doesn't that defeat the whole – I mean, it's like more demarcation of the land to like separate things rather than like talking about a landscape as a whole.
There are people who are real sticklers about
it. I understand.
I'm telling you that.
I think they should lighten up.
Anyway, so I grew up on the Great Plains, on the high plains of Midland, Texas, West Texas. And I remember that we had 11 inches of rainfall a year, but I looked it up and we actually had 14. So it was very sparse. So I'm attracted to literature, what I call literature of the Great Plains. And one of my very favorite practitioners of fiction of the high plains is Louise Erdrich, who is just about to get the Library of Congress Award for American Fiction this year and has 14 novels. And her first novel was set on a reservation. The second novel, The Beet Queen, she moved off the reservation to the small town of Argus, North Dakota. And the cover shows very flat, a beet field, and this is High Plains. This book begins in 1932, and there are two characters here who the book opens with, and one is Carl and one is Mary. And Mary is very sturdy and practical, and Carl is very fragile. And one of the interesting paradoxes of the book is that what's ugly endures and what's pretty dies. And this is sort of figures into the notion of the prairie. And another interesting character is Wallace. Wallace is the president of the chamber, Argus Chamber of Commerce. And he lives in a suburban development at the edge of the sugar beet field. And he has been a big promoter of the sugar beets. And in the basement rec rooms of these houses on these cul-de-sacs are like lamps in the shape of stagecoaches and lamps in the shape of canoes. This is sort of the diminished West. And so this is like the external geography of North Dakota and the plains and the internal geography makes for some pretty rooted and grounded characters. But really what lifts this novel is Erdrich's incredible writing and also her wonderful humor.
And so, that's The Beet Queen?
The Beet Queen. She now has 14 novels, and I think there are about 5 Argus novels, but really a wonderful book. She's like, I would say she's my favorite writer. Today.
Wow. Where does Love Medicine take place? I don't remember.
It's sort of a grab bag of stories set on the reservation, the Chippewa or Ojibwe reservation. It's right by Argus.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
That's my favorite novel of hers. I really like that novel.
Oh, that's a very inspired novel. I agree with that. Yeah.
That one's beautiful.
Looks like I've got another author to check out. Jeff, what else did you bring?
Yeah. Okay. I'm not sure. I think I'll talk about Bent Road by Lori Roy. Lori Roy grew up in Kansas, in Manhattan, Kansas. And I think she lived in Kansas City for a while and worked for Hallmark. And now she lives in Florida. And this I would characterize as sort of Plains Gothic. There's a murder in the past. There's a murder in the future. And there...
A murder in the future?
Not in the future. I'm sorry. Murder in the... Yeah, well, as it opens, right? Murder in the present, right?
Somebody's gonna die.
Plains got that. That's right. There's a gun, and it's gonna go off. That's right. In any case, this is Plains literature, and there are a lot of tumbleweeds that are clotting at the fence line. There's high plains flora like devil's claw. There's poisonous wedge root. And the landscape here is seen as pretty menacing. The character here is Arthur Scott, and it's set in 1967, and he takes his family from Detroit, where there are race riots at the time, and moves to supposedly a more pastoral setting. Well, the pastoral setting is pretty darn creepy and pretty darn lonely, and the tumbleweeds are sort of shadowy presences, and it's not at all what they expected, and very eerie and very creepy. But I would really recommend this book. It's excellent. It was a Kansas Notable Book of the Year. It was reviewed favorably. I reviewed it favorably in the Kansas City Star. It was reviewed favorably on NPR and the New York Times Book Review. Now, the New York Times Book Review reviewer called it a stark study of the prairie.
Well, so that brings me to my next question.
I call it a plains book.
Well, but that's – so we have starkness, creepiness, tumbleweeds, loneliness. Speaking of not what you're expecting, this is shocking to me. I think the prairie is so beautiful and exciting and, like, full of life. But apparently I am just insane.
Well, I'm very glad that Mark brought In Cold Blood, because that made a list of 10 essential prairie novels that I was looking at last night. And I thought, oh, yes, aside from My Antonia, there's In Cold Blood, along with John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. And that's wonderful. It takes place on the prairie. Does that make it prairie literature? Because now we're going to start talking about what do we mean when we say prairie
literature.
We will
be talking about that very shortly, but I want to let Jeff finish her recommendation.
I knew that I would come in as sort of the anti-romantic person. And, I brought in also The Wonderful Wizard of Oz by L. Frank Baum, who was from the Dakotas, I think South Dakota. He had an itinerant career. He was a journalist. He was an actor. He was in Kansas exactly one time. And there is a passage here that is iconic, that is still what people think of Kansas. It talks about the sun baked the plowed land. It talks about the grass was not green. It talks about Auntie M crying when she hears Dorothy's laugh. And this is people's view of Kansas.
Frank L. Baum's Oz series.
L. Frank Baum.
Frank Baum, excuse me.
That's okay.
Welcome back. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with a roundtable of local book critics. Critics, please reintroduce yourselves.
Mark Luce from Barstow School.
Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, freelance writer and book reviewer.
Katie Mita-Torstover from the Kansas City Public Library.
We've been talking about books to read to get in a prairie kind of mood. Do you guys think there's such a thing as prairie lit?
I think that has to do with tone and atmosphere and not so much description of the land, but
sounds like yes, you think so?
Well, I don't know, because we were talking about descriptions of the land, and in the green room I asked Jeff, well, would Nancy Picard's Virgin of Small Plains qualify as prairie literature? It's sort of a gothic mystery. It'd be a good read-alike, I think, for Bent Road by Lori Roy. But it's a small town crime drama that takes place in a small town in Kansas. Does that qualify because it takes place in this remote town and weather plays a huge part in the plot? Does that count?
Yeah, one thing I would say, Scott Heim too is a wonderful writer who wrote Mysterious Skin and In Awe and We Disappear, which certainly have the sort of plains or prairie gothic, but they're not necessarily about the land per se. They're about other things, and the land happens kind of to be there. It's a tricky thing, because my first person, the first book that I thought of when I thought of the prairie outside of Willa Cather was All the Pretty Horses by Cormac McCarthy.
Yes.
But it's set in Mexico, but it seems to me it's almost like, is it rural? Like, it's not so much a geography as it's like a state. And in that novel, John Grady is worried about the encroaching modernism. And so he sets out for this thing that he wants to preserve, which is he wants to be a horseman and do this thing. And he has to go somewhere where that can still exist.
Where there's open land.
When I think about prairie or plains literature, I think about the land as almost a character. Also the weather. The wind in particular. One book I didn't get to talk about was Rima in the Weeds by Deirdre McNamara. And in that book, the Margaret's mother's wedding veil blows off her head because of the whipping wind. It seems like a great metaphor.
So it enters even scenes that aren't about this place, but it's a force.
right.
that permeates. Well, you know, I have a little theory, and I want you to indulge me for just a second. I think anyone who spent any time alone on the prairie, outside of a car and away from a major event or activity, has had this experience of being in this just there's an incredibly powerful aloneness, which is energizing and beautiful, and that makes you want to return to people and describe it to them. But it's so visceral and wordless that it's really hard to pin down in language. But you want to, and it launches you into these verbal gymnastics. And I think that might be how some of this powerful, gorgeous literature of the prairie is born, that desire to capture this really wordless thing. Does anyone feeling that?
Kent Hariff does that in Plain Song.
Mm-hmm. I think there's something humbling and empowering about being a small speck in a big landscape. I like that feeling. We were talking earlier about how when we go to the mountains, Mark and I both have this sensation of like, get out of the way. You know? I want to see the sky.
Yes, absolutely.
And the concept of internal geography versus external geography has come up. Do you all in this room have an internal prairie geography that works into how you read prairie literature?
As I don't.
I do.
From the East Coast.
I do. I think that oftentimes one of my I don't know if I would go so far as to call it a pet peeve, but overwritten descriptions of the land, especially of the prairie, like it needs to be concise. It can evoke beauty and all those things, but it has to be somewhat austere. It has to be somewhat stark, because it can be lush and gorgeous, but it can also be haunting, as we've talked about, because there's so much space.
We don't have callers right now, but I did a little survey of the KCUR staff and asked them what their favorite prairie books were, and we have lots and lots of feedback. One of Angela Elam, who hosts New Letters on the Air, she has a few recommendations that I want to run by you guys. Prairie Earth by William Least Heat Moon.
Sure. Oh, of course.
She says she read it 2 weeks after she moved to Kansas and found it very insightful about the land and people. And she also recommends These Were the Sioux by Mary Sandoz. It's about the Sioux and the Nebraska in the Nebraska Sandhills when she was a child in the early 19th century. Anyone read either of those?
I don't know that.
I haven't read that one.
I mean, I've heard of it. I haven't read it. But there's a lot of wonderful prairie or plains literature set in the Nebraska Sandhills. Jonas Agee is somebody who writes about the Nebraska Sandhills.
She also says that she still carries the late Carol Shields novel, The Stone Diaries, around in her imagination. I'm hearing an oh yeah.
Where is that? Canada?
I mean, that's Canada. Well,
Canada,
but then
yeah.
It's like some Alice Munro stuff. It's like,
oh, absolutely.
It's not in the city.
It's rural. Yeah.
Well, now when we talk about prairie literature, are we talking about Canadian prairie literature or American prairie literature? The prairie doesn't recognize a border.
Or even Mexican prairie.
Or, yeah. Yes.
The plains stretch up to Canada.
Well, so we will have to define the geography of the prairie some other show. If you're going to make a trip to the prairie sometime this spring, consult the list of books we'll post from this conversation online later today. Our critics' recommendations will be available at kcur.org/centralstandard, and staff favorites will be on the list too. Katie Stover, Mark Luce, and Jeffrey Angowdy are Central Standard's book critics. They've been known in former incarnations as book doctors, but from now on, you can expect them every season on Central Standard. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross.